Pittsburgh Section, National Council of Jewish Women, Oral History 2. An interview with Marcella Cohen Goldberg, Executive Director of the Pittsburgh Blind Association. This interview is being conducted on March 5th, 1974. The first thing I noticed about you was that you didn't wear glasses.
They're tucked away in my purse.
You do wear them sometimes.
Yes, I wear trifocals. You ever wear trifocals?
No, not yet.
One for distance, one for about 18 inches, and one for about 12 inches.
But that's
for
the kind of glasses, these are the glasses that people need normally.
Mm-hmm.
As we all get older, we
mm-hmm.
go from one type of glass
right.
into another. But I take it your interest in blindness did not come from a personal, your own problem at least.
Oh no.
You have no
uh-huh.
vision problem at
mm-hmm.
all. Did anybody
mm-hmm.
in your family ever have a vision problem?
Yes, I have some blind relatives. I have a blind aunt and had a blind uncle, sister and brother, who were blinded in their early childhood by typhoid fever. And
okay.
my aunt at this point is 95, so you
mm-hmm.
know this was a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But this really is not the basic reason for my being interested in this work. I'm primarily a medical social worker
mm-hmm.
and working out of a general outpatient department at Fall Clinic. Worked with eye problems and children with eye problems, and this is the origination of my interest.
You're a medical social worker, but you didn't particularly train for work with vision, did you?
After I worked at Falk Clinic for a while, yes, I went on to Massachusetts Eye and Ear, and took
mm-hmm.
special training in medical social work with patients with eye problems. Under a fellowship from the National Society for the Prevention of Blindness.
I see. The I think, at least for me, this would be the sense that I would fear losing the most. Would be most frightening to me to lose my vision. Is this how most people feel?
I think if you go back into our mores, this is true. You go back to the Bible. Who was allowed to beg? The lepers and the blind. We're the only people who were allowed to beg on the steps of the churches.
So,
and I think all of us basically have an innate fear of blindness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there but for the grace of God go I. And I have been amazed in all the years I've been working with people with eye problems, how many people are interested because somewhere in their background they've had someone who was blind. Generally an elderly person, grandparent, something like this, parent perhaps.
But you're saying that in your own family, even though you had this experience and saw your aunt and uncle blinded by typhoid fever, this isn't particularly what led you to the interest
in this problem.
You just were interested more or less in medicine, or in a phase of medicine as a medical social worker,
yes.
and working along
yes.
with medical problems, and you selected this particular area.
I'm not sure whether I selected it or whether I was selected for it. I really couldn't tell
you.
Tell
me more about that. What do you mean selected for it?
I was working in general clinics,
mm-hmm.
and a not young ophthalmologist who was also working in the clinic at the time decided that maybe it would be a good idea if we had someone trained in this specialty in the Pittsburgh area. And so she made arrangements with some people she knew, and ultimately out came the fellowship. and I spent 4 months up at Mass Eye and Ear taking this training, presumably to come back to do medical social work in a hospital outpatient setting.
I see.
Actually, though, I was here not more than back a little less than a year when I went to a community agency, to a PBA.
Do I understand, then, that you were probably the first medical social worker in this area who was specializing
no,
in this
I problem? Replaced a girl at the Pittsburgh Blind Association who had also been trained by the National Society for the Prevention of Blindness some time before, but she was in Pittsburgh for a very short time.
But certainly one of the first.
That's right.
And are there, at this time, many social workers who are interested in this particular phase of work?
Not too many around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And the National Society is no longer doing this kind of training, so that people who are in the field are picking up the training as they go along.
Which, of course, is always a good way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How old is the agency?
Well, Pittsburgh Blind Association started out as the Pittsburgh Workshop for the Blind 1910 as a local agency founded by Phoebe Restlander, Mrs. Phoebe Restlander, who, through the interest of the Council of Jewish Women, got this started. And she was sparked by Dr. William W. Blair, an ophthalmologist, who also was looking for a future for blind future place for blind people to work. The two of them started the Pittsburgh Workshop in 1910, was incorporated in, I think, 1912 as the Pennsylvania Association for the Blind. Then the founding board decided they would spread to other parts of Pennsylvania, other large areas, and before we knew it, the child gave birth to the parent. The Pittsburgh Workshop became a branch of
Pennsylvania.
The Pennsylvania Association, which now has 30 branches spread throughout Pennsylvania. We are the largest.
Mm-hmm.
We have changed our name legally, registered under the Fictitious Name Act as Pittsburgh Blind Association,
mm-hmm.
to identify us more closely as the Pittsburgh Area Agency.
You serve just Allegheny County?
Allegheny, primarily, yes. We do some work in surrounding counties on special request, but primarily our service agency is Allegheny County. We didn't get incorporated until 1953. The parent organization, the Pennsylvania Association for the Blind, and our branch always shared an administrator, board, offices in mm-hmm. our building. And when they moved to Harrisburg, I think in 1942 approximately, they took our charter and went to Harrisburg. And we were not aware that we were functioning without a charter until the early 50s. And so we were rechartered in 1953, which is a queer one. But we had to have our own identity in order to own property.
I'm going to stop this now. Just go right ahead.
Right. When you asked me before about my interest particularly in working with the blind, I was startled recently. The Ladies Hospital Aid Society had its 75th anniversary, and they did brief biographies of all their past presidents. And I knew this was coming through. But when I read the article, I was startled to find that during my mother's administration as president of Ladies Hospital Aid, the main activity and focus of that group was work with the blind. And I had never known that, or if I knew it, I had forgotten it. Maybe it's buried somewhere in my subconscious, but I was quite startled to see that.
It could very well be buried in
yeah.
your subconscious. What do you remember growing up with your mother as an active organization person?
Oh, my mother was God's gift to group workers. I'm one of seven children. I'm the sixth of seven children. And by the time I think my younger brother and I came along, my mother had raised her family pretty well, and she got interested in women's activities. And all through my childhood, I remember her being president of one organization after another, all the Jewish women's organizations mm-hmm. in the city, and great activity at home in relation to this. when I was in the School of Social Work and taking working group work, I used to say they didn't know anything about how to work with women. They should have listened to my mother.
You say you were the sixth of seven children. Yes. Your mother did not do work with the women's organizations before you and your brother were born?
Not to my knowledge. We had four boys 2 years apart, then a girl, and then I came along, and then another boy, and I think my mother was pretty busy.
Isn't it possible that her interest rubbed off on you? I think of social work as really professionalized women's volunteerism.
Oh, I think there's no question about it. That there was a great deal of influence in this, although I did not take social work when I went to college. I went to Carnegie Tech in those days, Carnegie Mellon, interested in liberal education, which you couldn't get at Carnegie Tech back in the years I went. And I ended up as a librarian.
I noticed that.
Simply because I came to my senior year and had no specialty with which I could get a degree, and the one that would take the broad educational background was library school. So I went to the Carnegie Library School for my senior year, but shortly thereafter went into work at Falk Clinic in the medical social work. My oldest brother was a physician, and my youngest brother is now a physician, so that we had ties there that were pretty obvious.
You didn't consider social work as a profession in your undergraduate days?
No. I was very young, much younger than the usual college student, I guess.
Why?
Well, I was out, I commencement was 2 weeks before my 20th birthday.
So you graduated?
And I really didn't know what I wanted to do, and I was the maverick in my class because every semester I was registered in a different course. And this didn't go in those days.
No. You were really ahead of your time.
Well, I wanted a liberal arts education, and I couldn't get it at Tech in any other way. I got it this way.
So you graduated from high school when you were 16. Does this mean you were skipping all kinds of grades?
Oh, yeah, pushed along. Not necessarily from any special ability, but I think there are people who got breaks and were pushed along in school.
More people did skip in those days, that's true, but they did have to have special ability, too.
I got into Tech just under the wire for age, but it was an interesting experience. I would say not do it with anybody else. I think I was too young. Mm-hmm. Socially, I was immature, and I had a rough time.
Yeah, well, that's always one of the problems when someone's ahead of his age group.
Before you turn this on,
we were talking about your family and the fact that you became a professional person, a social worker, possibly from the influence of your mother in community work and in community organizations. And you mentioned that your youngest brother is a doctor. And what about the other children in your family? Were they influenced by your mother's activities, do you suppose?
Well, my oldest brother was a very well-known physician in the university setting. He was in the Department of Pathology, and he was the chief pathologist at McGee Hospital for many, many years. He was father to my younger brother and me. There was enough age difference, and he influenced both of us greatly. I think he probably, he was in medicine before my mother got into community activities. Now, I don't know how you draw a relationship. But the next group of children were not primarily influenced in this way. My younger brother and I, you see, came along, and by the time my younger brother was five, my mother was involved in community activities. Mm-hmm. So there's no question but what we were both influenced, and he is a physician.
Yes, I was aware of that. I wanted to get back. You had mentioned something in passing about the Pittsburgh Blind Association being founded by Mrs. S. Leo Ruslander.
No, Mrs. Phoebe Ruslander. She's the mother. She was the mother of S. Leo Ruslander.
I see.
Mrs. Moses Ruslander was her name.
I see.
Let me tell you that story because I don't think too many people know about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it primarily from Dr. William Whiteman Blair, who was the professor of ophthalmology at the School of Medicine for many, many years, who was head of the department at the time I went up to Mass Pioneer to take my training. And when I came back to Pittsburgh, Dr. Blair told me this story. Mrs. Ruslander had originally come from Bradford, Pennsylvania. She had been a school teacher prior to her marriage. She came down to Pittsburgh to live, and one day she walked into Dr. Blair's office with two nieces and a nephew of hers, and for Dr. Blair to examine their eyes. And after Dr. Blair saw these three young people, he told Mrs. Ruslander that unfortunately there was nothing he could do for them, that they would be blind ultimately. They had a hereditary eye disease, and he saw no future for them except bring them down, get them educated in the school for blind children, and after that he didn't know what to say. And Mrs. Ruslander was very disturbed by this outlook, and she said to Dr. Blair, surely there must be some place where blind people can work if this is the future of these three children. And Dr. Blair told her of his frustration. At that time he was seeing many people blinded in industry in this area, coal mines and steel mills. And he said, I have nothing to offer them. And he took her out to the office and he said, look, here are three men. He said, I can do nothing for them, and I can't even tell them where they can go to work. Let's you and I get together and start a workshop for the blind. And he said to Mrs. Ruslander, with my influence in part of this community and your activity and influence with women's organizations, let's get something started. So she went back to the Council of Jewish Women, and they became interested in this project. I think National Council for Jewish Women had had some hand somewhere in work with the blind. And through that organization, she got to the Conference of Jewish Women's Organizations, mm-hmm. I'm not sure of the name of that,
mm-hmm.
and ultimately the Congress of Women's Clubs, and every women's organization in the area began to support the workshop for the blind. They had, they used to have in the old Wabash building, and I have pictures of it, Weeks for the Blind sponsored, with every day of the week sponsored by a different religious group. In other words, the Council of Jewish Women's Organizations had one day, the Catholic Women's Organizations had another day, down the line. And they used to have these fairs almost in the old Wabash building lobby. You're probably too young to remember the Wabash building. But I remember one picture in an early yearbook where Lillian Russell, who was living in Pittsburgh at the time, was the star of some kind of a musical event they had,
mm-hmm.
with a fundraising drive. Mm-hmm. But this continued to be an interest and activity of the Council of Jewish Women over the years. And Mrs. Ruslander died, I would think in the 40s. And her son, S. Leo Ruslander, who was an attorney in Pittsburgh, came onto the board in her stead. Mr. Ruslander is now on our honorary board, and the third generation of Ruslanders, Julian Ruslander, is on the board to maintain the interest of the family.
It's really quite a continuity there.
Yes. Yeah. And the Pennsylvania Association for the Blind calls Mrs. Ruslander its founding mother.
And it's true.
That's right.
It really would be true. I want to backtrack a little bit here. You told me how you first became interested in this particular phase of social work. This makes me wonder because of all the years that you have been with one agency. What some of your disappointments were with the agency, some of your frustrations with this kind of work.
I've had a varied career with the agency. I started out solely in a prevention of blindness program. And this was my main interest. I really got into casework service to the adult blind only because we had such financial difficulties at one point that most of staff was released to meet a budget. And this was the period that we were working, we were seeing all the retrolateral fibroplasia babies, the premature babies that were born too much oxygen blindness. And in changing staff and staff focus, I picked up the service to parents of newborn blind babies simply because I couldn't see discontinuing a program where they had had help. And from there I moved along to direct the whole welfare services, and since 67 I've been directing the entire agency. It's had its ups and downs. I've been times that I've been tempted to just pull up stakes and go elsewhere, but basically I think with it all, it's a real challenge to one's ingenuity. It's a there are no 2 days alike. It's a way of helping people, and this seems to be my raison d'etre.
Mm-hmm.
I can get as big a thrill out of a little bit of an accomplishment from a preschool blind child as can the parents. And it seems to me that if I can in any way help people live with either their own blindness or blindness in a family, then I've accomplished a mission. And as devastating as some of the experiences have been over the years, when I thought I can't go on with this, there's always been some little glimmer of light or hope that makes me want to keep going.
You never seriously considered then going to work for another agency?
Oh, no.
Or going into another field of social work?
No.
I understand about your satisfactions with social work. I do not have an MSW, but I work for the state with the Department of Public Assistance. And my own field is sociology. I did graduate work in sociology. And of course, call for action is a type of social work too, I would say.
I think that in all the years I've been at the agency, the thing that was most devastating to me emotionally was the situation with the blind babies. When the ophthalmologists, the pediatricians, and the obstetricians would see a newborn premature that they were desperately keeping alive go blind while they were keeping it alive and not knowing what to do about it, then after maybe 6 weeks in an incubator, they would tell the parents that they could take the babies home. Usually it was the father they told, you can take your, like on Friday, you can take your baby home on Monday, but we're sorry to tell you it's going to be blind.
Oh, my.
The emotional upheaval was terrific. And in most of the situations, and we had about 200 babies in the county. Medicine is good here. They kept these babies alive.
Mm-hmm.
The parents would, you know, be terribly upset. Well, what are we going to do? Some of them would say, I don't want to take the baby home. Some would say, I can't tell my wife. Someone would say, I want the baby, a variety of responses. And the physicians would say, well, we can't answer all your questions, but you go over to the association and see Mrs. Goldberg. And 9 times out of 10, they would come to me directly from the doctor. And maybe a 2-hour interview, and they would have enough to go home and tell their mate, or if two of them came in to decide they wanted to keep the baby. And I was emotionally so depleted that I would go home and my husband would know when I walked in the door. I'd walk in and he'd say, oh, another blind baby.
Were some of these babies put up for adoption or put into homes because the parents...
There were a few where the parents did not want them in the beginning. But by and large, we only had, I think, one or two who were not taken. One particularly that I can remember.
First reaction is, why did this have to happen to me?
Oh, yes.
Which is actually a normal reaction.
And the next reaction is, what do I see in the future? I've got a little baby girl. All I know of blindness.
Go ahead.
Oh, did you turn it off?
No, I didn't. I was going to.
All I know of blindness are the people I see in tin cups, with tin cups on the street. I've never known a blind person. Is this the future for my child?
Mm-hmm.
And the job was, and always is, this is a baby first, it's blind second. You take it home and you feed it just like you would any baby. You love it. You talk to it.
But that is really not enough direction. Take this child home and love it. The parent needs more support and more help than that.
We have caseworkers who go in on a regular basis.
And they need it. I would imagine the parent needs that continuous sustenance, really.
Alan, if you have a marriage that's been rocky, this doesn't solidify it in any way.
Oh, it usually makes it worse, doesn't it?
And it's...
We like to think that problems make people grow closer together, but...
it's not always true.
No.
It's a rough road to hoe. Without help.
How exceptional does a blind person have to be? You know, when you talk to me about skill craft and people are aware of the kind of work that the Pittsburgh Blind Association does, how exceptional does a person have to be to use his native intelligence to overcome his blindness? How many blind persons, what percentage who have the IQ are able to complete college or to do something beyond the skill craft or aside from the skill craft? Are there many?
They're representative of the entire population. You have people who don't go beyond eighth grade in the general population. You have people who go on, you've got a Leonard Stacey. Who can go on despite his blindness. The people whom we employ in the sheltered workshop for the most part are multi-handicapped. And this means that in addition to blindness, which is our entrance requirement, as it were, our eligibility standard, they have other handicaps. We have blind people there who are epileptic, who are mentally retarded, who are emotionally disturbed, who are hard of hearing, who are cardiacs, who are diabetics. You name the disease and we've got it, combined with blindness.
And does your agency give any special counseling for all these multitude of physical and emotional problems?
Yes, this is part of our casework service, help. Seeing that they get adequate medical care, helping them to work, giving them work assignments that are within their capabilities. We have some combined mentally retarded and emotionally disturbed people who could not sit down and count consecutively to five to put five items in a bag all day. And yet there are other things that they can do, and we make work adjustments to take care of this. They're not employable on the outside, but they certainly can earn a living in sheltered child.
What do they make?
Well, we're on a wages and hours contract. Instead of being $1.60 an hour, which is the federal minimum, as a sheltered workshop we're $1.20 an hour. But all of our people, or most of our people, are on piece rated jobs. And some of our very retarded people can average $1.40 an hour. Can't average the $1.60, but they're higher than the $1.20 minimum. On the other hand, we have some people whose productivity is almost nil, and we subsidize them to a minimum.
Well, it's wonderful. It certainly
makes them employed,
contributing to society.
That's right. Self-sustaining, contributing members of society.
It's wonderful.
And I would like to tell you just one little example, which is very meaningful and may answer why I've been in this for so long. Came through the shop one day and I talked to a young man who had just We had had him on about 6 different jobs, and there was nothing that he could do. Very handicapped, but socially very adept. His family had done a good job with him socially. I was walking through the contract department, and he heard my footsteps. I walk like a 2-ton truck. They all know me when I'm coming. And he sang out, "Hi, Mrs. G, isn't it a wonderful day?" And I stopped it, and I said, "How did you get to work this morning?" He said, "In the usual way. Why?" And I said, "It is teeming outside. It's really a lousy day. It's turning to sleet. It's going to be awful. How can you say it's a wonderful day?" And he sat there for a minute, and he said, "Mrs. G, it's a wonderful day for me. I'm working.
Aww.
You don't know what this means." Lena could have gone through the floor.